With us by telephone today is someone whose work I've used for years, so I'm just very, very pleased to be able to have him with us today, although it's in different, difficult circumstances. And I'm speaking of Peretz Kidron. Let me make sure that he can hear us first. Are you there, Peretz?
Yes, I hear you.
Thank you very much, and thank you so much for being with us this morning, our time.
Thanks for the invitation.
Let me just say that Mr. Kidron has long been a journalist in the Middle East. He writes for, among other places, and probably where I first encountered him was Middle East International, which can also now be found online at MEI Online, I believe. And he has for years reported from Israel. He has, when I say that he's been an activist, I think it's important to note that he was one of the people who, he's part of a group called Yesh Gavul, or was part of a group. I'll have to ask him that in a moment. Yesh Gavul.
No updates.
Excellent. And Yesh Gavul is an organization that was created in the late 70s or early 80s during the Israeli occupation of southern Lebanon, or much of Lebanon at some points. And it was formed by members of the Israeli Defense Forces who felt that they were being asked to do things that, which were not defensive, in fact. And so Yesh Gavul, I believe, means something like there is a limit or there is a boundary. There's something that should not be crossed. Is that a fair explanation?
That's accurate.
Well, we've asked you to be with us today because you, I know, have been writing about the pending and now the, in fact, happening withdrawal of or removal of Israeli settlers from the Gaza Strip. So I wanted to know whether you would begin by framing that for us, both in terms of what's happening right now on the ground, but also in terms of the impact inside Israel proper?
Well, I think that we have quite a number of changing perceptions in this whole story. For instance, I think that Ariel Sharon launched this whole project with very limited objective of covering his flanks, removing a number of vulnerable settlements, earning some credit points with international opinion as a peacemaker, and simply reducing the pressure on the Israeli army, on Israeli resources, because these settlements are an enormous drain on Israeli resources. It's just difficult to describe. One settlement with 60 families that was defended by an entire battalion of soldiers. So this was just untenable in the long run, and it seemed as though he was only going to make a tactical withdrawal. What's happened is, as a result of this, is a split between Sharon and his followers and what were once his closest allies and protégés, the settlers themselves, particularly the hardcore of the settlers, the fanatical religious nationalists who see in the settlement, in the colonization of the whole of the land of Israel, a messianic undertaking. And they couldn't possibly go along with Sharon's pragmatic reasoning. The result is a total breakdown of this historic alliance, which has held out for decades, and we now have Sharon, the public enemy number one among the settlers. And another expectation that was disappointed, or shall we say the projection, the reality was nothing near what had been projected, is the way the settlers took it. Because the settlers have been a sort of specter in Israeli politics. Mm. And it's been a truism among Israeli politicians that you don't mess with them because they're an enormously powerful force. They have at their disposal countless volunteers, enormous resources, great deal of courage and dedication and devotion. And if you mess with them, you're in trouble. Mm. And when it came to a showdown, and when the Israeli government and the authorities exercised their rights. After all, this is a law. The law is approved by the legislature, and applied the right and duty to enforce that law. They met this very loud opposition from the settler movement and threats of massive civil disobedience of hundreds of thousands of people flooding the highways and making it impossible, in fact, reinforcing the settlement and the settlements in Gaza and making it impossible to evacuate them. What's happened, in fact, is that the settlers themselves in Gaza, the overwhelming majority, have already left, not willingly, but at least peacefully. And the only holdout at this moment are a couple of thousand youngsters, mainly not from the settlements themselves, but recruits from various racist and fairly unruly elements that have been running wild in the West Bank and have nothing to do with the Gaza settlement. And they're the ones who are putting up the fight. So this specter, this ogre that we were taught to fear and respect has turned out to be, to change metaphors, to be a bit of a paper tiger. And I think that's a very important lesson for Israelis to learn. True, there's a lot of weeping and heartbreak and so on, and one feels sorry for the settlers, but ultimately it hasn't turned out to be that painful an operation to remove these settlers from the Gaza Strip. And I hope that that's the way it will be interpreted in the Israeli public, that this is something that was considered unthinkable, and it turns out to be thinkable, difficult, but not impossible.
So you had written on July 15th on a piece entitled Orange Rampant, that there had been within Israel itself a visible movement of people wearing or having orange banners on their cars, etc., which was identified as support for the settlers and for the non-removal of them from the Gaza Strip. And that, I believe you said that the idea of sporting the blue and white, which are the colors of the Israeli flag, was actually being intimidated. Our people were being intimidated from doing that. So is that also part of the specter that you, or the hollow one?
Yes, indeed. I mean, let's not underrate it. There is broad support for the settlers. There is a broad right-wing constituency. And the thousands of orange ribbons did represent, indeed, opposition to the withdrawal, to the disengagement plan. But I'm not talking about legitimate opposition, which is the right of every citizen in a democracy. So this is a minority that exercised its right to free speech by carrying these ribbons, these orange ribbons that indicated that they're against the disengagement and against removing the settlers. But when it came to a showdown, and when the settlers desperately called up these hundreds of thousands of supporters that seemed to be out there, the supporters just didn't turn up. For one thing, because the majority of them are law-abiding citizens in a democracy, and they realize that this is a legitimate majority decision, which the minority may feel sore and angry, but has to obey. It's just like, you know, if the majority decides you stop at a red light, you stop at a red light. There's a minority that thinks otherwise, they can't simply enforce that on the majority. So the majority of the people are on the right wing are people with conservative opinions but living in a democracy. What we have, this unknown quantity and quality, this element of extremist fanatics are among the settlers, are very violent people and very violent in their behavior, first and foremost vis-a-vis the Palestinians, but also vis-a-vis Israeli soldiers and policemen who in any way try to prevent their rioting and their attacks on their Palestinian neighbors. So the unknown quality or quantity was how many of these thousands of these people would turn up and would they wage a pitched battle against the Israeli security forces. And they did turn up. They're up to all kinds of mischief, very destructive, and they're used to running wild. They're used to not being disciplined in any way. But what they've done so far mainly consists of puncturing the tires of the trucks that are coming in to pick up the families who want to leave these settlements. That's about the full extent of their violent resistance. So it's a bit... it's a bit childish, and actually the overwhelming majority of the resistors are youngsters from high schools in the summer vacation, and this whole thing is turning into a kind of adventure summer camp where instead of inventing the games, they're actually playing real games against the Israeli police and army.
Mm. So for those resistors, are they being imprisoned, or is there what is the sanction, I guess, for not leaving the settlements? Was my question.
Well, there's very little in the way of sanction. That's one of the problems, that the settlers, whether in the West Bank or in Gaza, have been given a pretty free hand. They can do more or less what they want. And they have instituted a reign of terror against their Palestinian neighbors. They're a tiny minority there, but they're armed and they're tough and they're ruthless and they're allowed to do anything they like. And complaints to the Israeli authorities, which are, after all, responsible for law and order in the occupied territories, have just led to nothing. So there have been countless cases of beatings and land grabs and people and Palestinians being killed by these people, mm-hmm. and groups and posses going into Palestinian villages and shooting them up in revenge for some real or imagined offense on their part. So they've been allowed to run free, and on very few occasions has anybody wrapped them over the knuckles. But what's happening now is a slight shift. In that, now they're coming up, they are challenging the Israeli authority. As long as they were simply brutalizing Palestinians, nobody was worried. But now they challenge the authority of the Israeli government, the Israeli army. They were trying to get soldiers to disobey orders. And so the full weight of authority, the police command, the army command, the political leadership around Sharon, with a lot of backing from public opinion, are coming down on them hard. So there's certainly a firm show of force. The question is, will any of these offenders be punished? I'm rather afraid that they'll get away with it yet again. But they will be put in their place because they will be removed. Mm. The army is absolutely intent on that. And in fact, you know, it looks as though the whole operation is going to be over in a few days, when the army had been preparing for this to drag on for a month or more.
Mm. And as I recall, Ariel Sharon had indicated that if necessary, he would shut everything down for 2 weeks to accomplish it. So that's he's not going to have to do that either, huh?
Well, indeed, one of the ironies of this whole situation is that the settlers and the settlements have been an enormous drain on the Israeli economy. They cost a lot to put up. They cost a lot to maintain. Huge sums of money are funneled in through all sorts of channels, backroom, under the counters, illegal, semi-legal. And now, again, removing them again is enormously costly, but at least when the cost of removing them is looks as though it'll be the last that will be spent on at least this particular group of settlers.
Well, let me ask some other questions. I mean, there are two or three directions I want to go in at once, and obviously I can't go in all of them. But I guess the most important one right now is this really about disengaging and allowing for a meaningful Palestinian state or entity, as it's sometimes called? Or is this a way of consolidating control over areas of the West Bank for the Sharon government? I guess in another simpler way, is this a cynical move, or is it one that might embolden the government to begin withdrawal from the West Bank settlements?
Well, it's certainly a cynical move. There may be further withdrawals in mind, but the idea is a cynical maneuver with the aim of getting rid of the Palestinians. The late Yitzhak Rabin, who in his later days became, I think, a true peacenik, but was very hostile towards the Palestinians, and he once very famously said he would love to wake up one morning and discover that Gaza had simply sunk into the sea.
Mm-hmm.
And in that way, I think that he expressed a sentiment, a feeling that many Israelis have, that really they don't quite know what to do about the Palestinians. The Palestinians are there, and they're hostile, and they stand up for their own demands and rights. Well, what can we do about them? And there's this sort of wish fulfillment game where they disappear in some way or other. And you might say that this separation wall is a way of fulfilling that wish of Rabin. The Palestinians would be behind the wall, under control, out of sight, out of the way. And that represents a pretty broad sentiment. And unfortunately, it isn't balanced, or at least offset by the understanding that the Palestinians are our closest neighbors, and we are their closest neighbors, and that we have to work out some kind of deal for coexistence with them. And unfortunately, the Israeli leadership does deal with the Palestinians, but deals not on a basis of equality, not on a basis of accepting that they too have their rights and demands and have a right to stand up for them. It's very much a matter of dictating. Mm. And I think it's no coincidence that this withdrawal, it's stressed over and over again, is unilateral. Israel decided to withdraw, just as a few years ago, El Barak decided to withdraw from Lebanon. And that also was a unilateral decision. We decide when we go in, we decide when we go out. There's no need to deal with our Arab neighbors on a basis of equality. And that all too often characterizes Israeli diplomacy, or lack of diplomacy, because dictating terms to the other side is not diplomacy. That's just a militarist mindset.
Mm. My question had to do with some of that, underpinning some of this action, in terms of either it being a cynical ploy or essentially a symbolic action of some kind. In either event, is there any process involved wherein the Palestinians can then populate the space that is being vacated by these encampments or settlements?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the question.
Oh, I'm sorry. Let me repeat it. Maricela is farther away from the phone. We've sort of things cobbled together because of we're repairing a studio. But the question was whether or not whether there are mechanisms now for Palestinians to go in and occupy the territory that's being vacated.
Oh, yes. The idea is to hand over the territory to the Palestinians when the evacuation is being completed about a month or so from now. And it's a very important addition for the Palestinians because the Gaza Strip, you must know, is one of the most crowded places on earth, mm-hmm. and the settlers have been had occupied or rendered unusable about one-third of the land. So they, 7,000 settlers grabbed one-third of the land, and the other two-thirds were left for, listen to the number, 1.3 million Palestinians.
Mm-hmm.
So this additional land that becomes available will be very welcome to likely relieve the pressure on the Palestinian population there.
But on the downside, the entire territory is being sort of walled in, both from on the land and from the sea. Is that not so?
Yeah, that's it. This is part of the contradiction. On the one hand, there's this desire to get rid of Gaza. Let's get the hell out of there. But on the other hand, let's keep control. So what is happening is that this Gaza, this rectangle, where we're on the four sides, two sides is Israeli territory, a third side is the Mediterranean where the Israeli Navy patrols and effectively imposes a blockade, and then an agreement has now been reached with the Egyptians that they block off the fourth side.
Mm-hmm.
So any person, a pin or a needle that goes in or out of Gaza has to go through under Israeli control. And of course, it's impossible for the Palestinians who are left in there to establish any kind of independent existence, certainly an independent economy, when they're under such total control. They're not allowed a harbor, they're not allowed an airport. Everything has to go through Israel, which makes it much more expensive, much harder for them to develop. And it is very urgent because Gaza, in addition to being crowded and overpopulated, is very, very poor. And there are alarming figures about the number of children that are malnourished there, and the social situation there is extremely difficult. So a kind of peace deal, and here it would come back to the unilateral element, where Israel simply walks out and walls in the Palestinians and leaves them to their own devices, that isn't going to end the violence, because the Palestinians are going to be left in desperate straits. And if they're in an impossible situation, that can only encourage more violence rather than turning towards peaceful coexistence.
Mm. One of the most ironic bits that I heard on, I think it was CNN this morning, was one of the Israeli settlers who was being removed saying, well, why can't we just live side by side? Why can't they be my neighbor? And, you know, why do I have to be removed from my home? Which, of course, is a very old song, but not usually sung by the settlers.
No, of course not. And it shows the kind of bubble in which they live, the sort of their totally enclosed world, with very little or no understanding or empathy for the plight of the Palestinians. They were brought in there on the banners of the Israeli army. Land was grabbed for them. Their presence there has inflicted enormous suffering on the Palestinian population. They never cared about what happens to those neighbors when they're under attack by the Israeli army. And now all of a sudden, when they're being removed, they suddenly discover that these people are their neighbors. It shows a sort of very much a double standard, if not more than double.
Mm. And I know that there have been reports that the settlers will be compensated, and in some instances, I think they have to have owned their homes, will be given housing. One of my questions is this going to be in the new settlements that are continuing to be built on the West Bank, or are they coming?
Not necessarily. I think the overwhelming majority are moving into pre-67 Israel. There may be some individuals going to the new settlements, but that doesn't really matter. I mean, one of the problems, the political, the double dealing, at the same time that the Israeli government is moving 1,700 families out of Gaza, it's given the okay for the construction of 3,000 housing units on the West Bank.
Mm-hmm.
So that the settlement drive is being kept up there, even after the bitter lesson that the whole enterprise in Gaza was an exercise in futility, with enormous cost in human suffering and human life, and enormous financial cost. And while the government seems to have sobered up on one front, in another sector they're continuing to pursue exactly the same policy.
Mm. One of the things, let me say first that we are speaking with Peretz Kidron from Israel. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
I wanted to ask about the Israeli military itself. As you suggested earlier, certainly their task has been far easier than was anticipated. But I had read a piece by Meron Rappaport in Le Monde Diplomatique indicating that members of the military, the units who are going to be involved, had indicated that they would refuse to do this, to remove settlers, that they were sympathetic to them, and so on. So what I would like you to comment, particularly as someone who is part of Yesh Gavul and has been a critic of the Israeli military, is to talk about what's happening therein. We've got a military that all citizens are meant to serve in, and that, you know, I guess it's almost 20 years ago now, but maybe not quite so long, was thought to be invincible, that it was solid, that it was of one mind, etc. And now with, you know, the kind of statement that Rappaport relays, and with what we know that's been happening with the refusal to serve in occupied territories, what does this portend for the Israeli military?
Well, first of all, there's a couple of points I'd like to make before I really answer that. First of all, this is part of the smokescreen I spoke about, that the, if the army were ever told to act against the settlers, hundreds, thousands of soldiers, would entire units would refuse to obey orders, and this would destroy the army. And we heard of this, 10,000 soldiers had signed. When it came down to it, the numbers of refusals by right-wing soldiers, and bear in mind, under pressure, enormous pressure from their rabbis and teachers, these rabbis openly calling on them to disobey orders, the number of actually disobeyed so far run into a few dozen. Maybe there are others who shirked their duties, but they're always soldiers who shirked duties. There's nothing exceptional about that. But the idea of a massive wave of refusal by settlers and their members of youngsters from the settlements who are serving in the army, it just hasn't materialized. So this just goes to show that the settler threat, that they kind of blew themselves up out of all proportion, and in actual fact they're a paper tiger. They're much less there. There's much less power and resolution than we had all thought. Now, a second point I'd like to make: people here, particularly the Israeli army and the Israeli authorities, like to lump together these people who are currently refusing to remove the settlers and the refusing movement of soldiers who have refused for 30 years or more to serve in the occupied territories. These are two entirely different phenomena. There's no way you can compare them, though the Israeli establishment tried to say it's more, these people refuse on the right and others refuse on the left. It's not the same. Let me take an American analogy. During the civil rights movement in the 60s, both sides, the African Americans and the white supremacists, broke laws. But the boycotts, the sit-ins and so on, broke laws deliberately because they were racist laws, and they broke those laws with the aim of ending racist discrimination. On the other side, the supremacists broke laws because they were trying to maintain that racist segregation and the discrimination against the black population. So we have, I would make that analogy here. The soldiers who refuse to serve in the occupied territories are protesting against the denial of the most basic human, civic, democratic rights from the Palestinian people. The Palestinian people have absolutely no rights under the Israeli occupation. The Israeli officers, the Israeli governors, are total tyrants. And Palestinians simply have to obey. This is forced upon them by the sheer brute force and the military superiority of the Israeli army. And this is a totally unacceptable situation, which is essentially disenfranchised the entire Palestinian people. They have no democratic rights. And it's in protest against that that the refuseniks have been by many hundreds, probably something approaching 4,000 over the years, have gone to prison because they refused to serve in the occupation. Now, when the settlers or their allies refuse to obey orders, that's a whole different situation, because these people are part of the Israeli democratic system. They've been given every right to express their view, conduct their campaign, lodge their protest. They're represented in parliament, in the government, in administration, in the army. They have the vote. They have access to. They have the right of free speech and freedom of assembly and demonstration and so on. And they were simply outvoted. So it can in no way be compared. This is lawlessness. What they're doing is simply lawlessness. To go back to my previous analogy, they think that they can go through the light when it's orange, when the decision is that when it's orange, you stop. When it's red, you stop. But they've decided the orange color gives them the right to go through those traffic lights whenever they want. And this is a completely different situation. So I think they should be treated separately. But finally, now this is a long introduction to the question. What happens down in the Israeli army? Well, the Israeli army is shown once again. The Israeli army is a conscript army, and therefore it's conscripted from almost all sections of Israeli Jewish society. Palestinian Israelis, who make up nearly 20% of the population, aren't conscripted. But the army reflects the Jewish population, and so it reflects refuseniks who are protesting against the occupation and going to prison. It also reflects extreme right-wing fanatics. We just had another shooting incident today, by the way, a couple of hours ago. A settler took it, just grabbed a gun and killed and murdered three Palestinians, including a couple that he'd just driven to work. All these elements exist in Israeli society, and the Israeli army represents that society. And it's not so bad. I think that with all my criticism of the Israeli army, I'd rather see an army of conscripts rather than an army of so-called volunteers, as exists in the United States and most of Europe. I think that, that an army of conscripts is a much more democratic institution, much less likely to guards of control.
Well, let me ask, we're just about out of time, but I want to ask at least one more thing for American listeners, and that is the role the U.S. is now playing in the Middle East, in Israel and the occupied territories specifically, certainly. What role you see it playing, what it should be playing at this point?
Well, the role that it's been playing, and in this instance, the Bush administration is rather like the Clinton administration before it, convinced somehow that smiles and coaxing will get people to the negotiating table and somehow work out a deal. Mm-hmm. And what people may not understand in the United States is that what is needed here is not American smiles, but American scowls. And let me give you a historical example. You know, the Americans brokered the peace talks between Menachem Begin, the then Prime Minister of Israel, and Sadat, the President of Egypt, and at the famous Camp David meeting that actually prepared the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. But there were Israeli settlements in the Sinai as well, in the occupied Egyptian Sinai that Israel held at the time. There were Israeli settlements there, and Begin was committed to preserving those settlements. So when it came to the really tough negotiation, Begin explained to Jimmy Carter, who was presiding over the talk, he said, I can't withdraw from those settlements. We've got to keep them. And Carter reportedly said, well, in that case, Mr. Prime Minister, you're on your own. Now, that is the kind of arm-twisting, and he didn't smile. He was deadly serious. And that's the kind of arm-twisting that the Americans, with their power in this part of the world, and with their, particularly the influence over Israel, can exert and can get things done, not by smiling and not by sending messages of sweetness and light, but by twisting arm. Not because Israel needs to be dictated to, but because it's much easier for an Israeli politician to say, I have to make that concession because the Americans forced me to. Israelis are very concerned about keeping a connection with the United States, and therefore the United States can impose, it can force Israel quite a long way down the road to peace. So what's needed is the kind of tough talk that occasionally, actually, Republicans seem to be better at it than Democrats in some cases. I'm thinking of James Baker giving out the White House phone number for any time the Israelis want to call. So that kind of tough talk will be much more effective in pushing Israel and the Palestinians along the road to peace by simply twisting arm. That's really what the United States can and really have the responsibility to do, to twist arm, because It's only because of American support that Israel has been able to maintain the occupation. Mm-hmm. Therefore, the United States bears responsibility for ending the occupation and thereby bringing about an end to the conflict.
Well, excuse me. Is there anything that we haven't asked you at this point that you would like to share with our listeners, Peretz Kidron?
Well, I'd like to stress again the point I made at the outset, that what Israel is going through in these days was presented was going to be a huge drama, terrible tragedy, and the enormous resistance by wide sections of the Israeli public and clashes and so on. And it's turned out to be much easier, much less traumatic than we had been prepared. And that when one of Sharon's aims in putting through this plan was to show the world how terribly difficult it is to move settlers. And in fact, it turns out that not to be that difficult. And that should be borne in mind for the future when Israel will have to remove much larger numbers of settlers from the occupied West Bank.
Well, thank you so much for your time this morning. We really do appreciate it. And I want to again mention that you can, if you Google Peretz Kidron, P-E-R-E-T-Z-K-I-D-R-O-N, you'll come up with a whole long list of articles. But you are still writing for Middle East International?
Yes, indeed, but let me plug my own commercial. I brought out last year a book about the Refusnik movement. It's called Refusnik, published by Zed Press, and it's available in independent bookstores and on Amazon and so on. And I can praise the book because I didn't write 90% of it. It's really an anthology, written declarations by Refuseniks, their defense statements, and explaining why they're taking this step. And I think that it says a great deal about the anti-occupation movement, the Refusnik movement in Israel, and presents it in its most powerful way.
What's the title once more?
Refuseniks is the title again, and it's from Zed Press. Zed Press is located in England, but it's carried by many bookstores in the U.S., and as Peretz Kidron said, you can also get it via Amazon. They cross borders, probably sometimes when they shouldn't. But we want to thank you again, and it's been... as I said, for me, from the beginning, because I've read your work for a very long time, a particular pleasure this morning. So thank you very much.
Thank you for having me and for posing me such good questions.
Excellent. All right. We're just about out of here for today. Stanley is here. He's going to be playing some jazz. And actually, I have to say that today's my anniversary, and to my partner, Cedric, I want to... go out with a piece from Carmen McRae. This is KCSB FM Santa Barbara, 91.9 on your dial. I'm Elizabeth Robinson.
And I'm Maricela Marquez, congratulating the Robinsons on how many years of marriage?
Oh, 38. so long, it's embarrassing. Good morning.
This next one was written by Miss Billie Holiday. My man don't love me. He treats me, oh, so mean. My man, he don't love me. He treats me, oh, so mean.
Holiday song.
Oh, I have to say, my man, he don't love me. Is that what you play for your partner on your anniversary? Only if you're a little zipper-headed. I just picked the wrong one, but we're going to keep going with, as Stanley says, this Billie Holiday song.
He wears high draped pants. His stripes are really yellow. I said that cat wears high draped pants. His stripes are really yellow. But when he starts in to love me, ooh, he's so fine and mellow. Love will make you drink and gamble. love will make you stay out all night long. Y'all know what I'm talking about. I said love will make you drink and gamble. It'll make you stay out all night long. Love will make you do things that you know is wrong. Now you can take my word for this next chorus here. If you would like a translation of this, meet me right after the show and I'll explain it all to you. Hey, if you treat me right, baby, I'll stay home every day. Every day. Hold it. I said, if you treat me right, Daddy, I will try and stay home every day. Ain't no need to be lying up here. But you are so mean. You are mean. You're mean to me, baby. And I know you're gonna drive. Turns off and it turns on. I said that love is just like a faucet. It turns off and on. Sometimes when you think it's on, baby, it has turned off and gone.
You're listening to KCSB 91.9 FM in Santa Barbara. Gone.